You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's been 60 years since an April 1955 news conference that announced that Jonas Salk's vaccine against polio worked. The news of the results of the largest clinical trial ever held in medical history was greeted by church bells tolling, horns honking, sirens ringing as the whole nation celebrated. Special editions of newspapers rolled out. Churches and synagogues held impromptu services. It was perhaps the biggest celebration since VJ Day 10 years earlier. Today it's hard to understand the anxiety that polio induced in parents in the first half of the 20th century. In several surveys, it was as scary as nuclear weapons in the early 1950s. But Jonas Salk changed that. Humbly born in a New York tenement, in all of his endeavors, he seemed to be driven to improve the world. Biographer Charlotte DeCruz Jacobs tells his story of his overshadowed work on the first influenza vaccine, his work to create the polio vaccine, his work later in creating the Salk Institute, as well as his unsuccessful and pioneering work on AIDS in the book Jonas Salk, A Life, published by Oxford University Press. Salk was idolized by the public around the world, yet strangely snubbed by the scientific community. He didn't receive the Nobel Prize in Medicine and was blackballed by the National Academy of Science. Charlotte Jacobs tells this story. She is a professor of medicine at Stanford University, has served there as a senior associate dean and as director of the Clinical Cancer Center. She's also the author of Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease. Her new book, Jonas Salk, A Life. Charlotte Jacobs, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of how you began deciding to write about Jonas Salk. What was the entry point for you?
Well, that started probably a long time ago. When I was a child growing up in Kingsport, Tennessee, it was prior to the polio vaccine era. So I grew up seeing children struggling with braces and news clippings of kids in iron lungs, and we were all very scared during the summer. In 1954, my hometown, Kingsport, Tennessee, became a site for the national trial of the polio vaccine, and I was actually a polio pioneer. So much later in life, as I began to get involved in biography writing, I thought about Salk as a subject, and two main questions intrigued me. He was beloved by the public, but he was shunned by the scientific community. I didn't know why. And having reached acclaim at age 40, what did he do for an encore? I couldn't find a biography to give me the answers, and so I set out to write one.
Now, give us a sense of what it was like in that summer of the polio trial as a polio pioneer, and that was the name given for the kids, this mass study that tried out the Salk vaccine. Give us a sense of what it was like. I mean, what do you remember about the fears and apprehensions of being a part of that trial?
Well, the trial itself wasn't what was scary. What was scary is the years preceding it. Particularly, I remember going to the movie theater, and they had newsreels before the main attraction. And always there was something about polio, and there were pictures of these kids, I would say, entombed in iron lungs. And it was very scary. And one of the problems is you never knew who the next victim was going to be. So there was a fear that kind of hung over everyone during the summer and kind of put a damp on your summer fun, as it would be. So when our town was selected as a site, I don't remember too much hoopla. I was in the second grade, and our teacher told us to line up, that we had been selected to get a shot to see if it would protect polio. I think most kids were more concerned about how would it hurt. And would you get a lollipop when it was done? So we didn't, in the second grade, we didn't have a sense of pride, so to speak. It was kind of like going to the doctor's office.
And that second year, that was the grade that they decided to test this
yes.
vaccine on?
So there were actually two trials going on simultaneously, mainly because of some political maneuverings. One of the trials was that every second grader in a particular site got the Salk vaccine, and they compared the incidence of polio to those in the first and third grade who were the control group. Other sites, there was a randomization of kids in the second grade, and so everybody in the second grade was either given a shot or a placebo, saline, and no one knew who got which one. And I think, I can't find out in the archives in my hometown, but I think that my school was a site where everyone got polio vaccine.
And it's hard to remember now today how fearful people were of polio. Your book reminds us that next to the fear of the atomic bomb, the fear of polio every summer in America was the greatest fear Americans had.
That's absolutely right.
It almost had a fear beyond the actual power of the disease, although the disease was bad. I mean, we're talking less than 100,000 cases a summer, something like that.
Right, about, I think the top one in 1952 was almost 58,000. But remember, it struck mostly children. It wasn't the elderly that got it. It was young children. And so I think part of it was that if we minded our mothers, if we went to church every Sunday, if we ate our vegetables, if we were the best kids we could be, we could still be the crippler's next victim. There was no prediction which town and which child would get attacked. And once you got it, there was no cure for it. So those were some of the elements that made it so fearful.
Well, as you began researching into Jonas Salk, Salk was sort of interesting because, as you mentioned, there was this great divide between the immunologists and the professional researchers and, of course, his reputation outside of that. And that's because he took an unusual route. He became an MD. He became a doctor. But he wanted to specialize in research, and he didn't do the PhD route. Was that really at the heart of this conflict between the professional?
No, I think that was probably a minor conflict. Back then, a lot of the scientists or people that did clinical research were MDs, so the prevalence of the MD-PhD was not anywhere near as high as it is today. I think there were several reasons that Jonas Salk was kind of snubbed by the scientific community, if you will. One is that he was a very young researcher at the time, and he was not really one of those who belonged to the kind of scientific brotherhood, if we would. He was really in his 30s when he started working on the polio vaccine. And all of his work was supported by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which ran the big March of Dimes campaign. Mm-hmm. So all of his funding actually came from the general public. But he initially tested the polio vaccine in secret, even though he was a part of this a large group of supported researchers by the March of Dimes. So he kind of moved out ahead when they were kind of going lockstep in a certain order in which they were going to work on a vaccine. Secondly, at that time, all senior virologists believed that the only vaccine that would be effective is one made from a live virus, a weakened live virus, and using smallpox as the example. And Salk believed that you could actually kill a virus and still keep its immunogenicity, that is, its ability to stimulate an immune response without any of the risk of getting the disease. So in that, he challenged the big leaders in the field. The second is they said he failed to give proper credit to other researchers once he became so famous, which was, of course, the day, April 12, 1955, when the polio vaccine was shown to be successful. And he did try to give credit to other people, but the news media made him the icon for the whole polio story. And even if he talked about other researchers, that wasn't very appealing to the public. They wanted to hear more about Jonas Salk. So I think the third is he reached out to the public in ways scientists never had done. He answered every single letter that he got from the public. He felt they deserved that. They had supported all the research. They were part and parcel of this. And in that, scientists said he crossed the line of academic decorum and was soliciting media attention. So there was a lot of back and forth. Not that he wasn't to blame a little bit. He called himself, he used to say he marched to a different drummer. He did not behave like a typical academic scientist in his approach. It's complex, which made the book so much fun to write.
Yeah, I would imagine. And let's talk about that first idea that he really, and this started at a young age, because one of the stories you tell is his work on an influenza vaccine. This was his really first success. He was a part of a team effort there in which he was a junior member of, but it sounds like he contributed a lot of thinking to the first influenza vaccine. And from the very beginning, he believed that you could transfer immunity through a dead virus.
Exactly.
Tell us a little bit about his work on the influenza vaccine, where he first came up with this idea.
Yeah, so he didn't actually first come up with it, but he had just finished his medical training, and he had done some basic research during medical school, which was pretty unusual at that time, with Thomas Francis Jr., who had moved on to the University of Michigan. And he wanted to go and work with him after his medical training. Well, that was the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We were getting ready to enter the war, and it brought back this terrible fear of what happened in World War One, because in World War One we had the great influenza pandemic that killed millions around the world, and almost as many young men died from influenza as died from combat. So there was this real push to develop an influenza vaccine as soon as possible, and Thomas Francis was the head of the Commission on Influenza. So Salk went to work with him, and Francis had already done some basic work in influenza. So Salk was his junior person, so to speak, and they did make and tested the first influenza vaccine. And Salk didn't get much credit for it, and I think his polio work has kind of overshadowed his influenza work, which was very important. But then what they realized quickly is this wasn't like smallpox. It wasn't just one virus. There were lots of different strains of influenza, and they mutated so that you kind of couldn't get ahead of it. And Salk came up with a very clever way to be able to add lots of different strains to one single shot by adding some mineral oil, which potentiated the effect of the virus, and therefore you could have a tiny amount of virus and add multiple ones. But again, he was kind of impeded by the political maneuverings of the senior scientists, and he was very frustrated. And when he was approached by the March of Dimes to work on polio, he left the field of influenza.
Yeah, and it sounds like from that idea about mineral oils, and there's a particular word that...
Adjuvant is the word.
Yeah, adjuvant. Mm-hmm. This sort of drew the ire of professional immunologists and the PhDs and the heads of sort of these research institutes that went against their ideas of how it should work.
That was part of it. The other was, which I think is what they were using as a reason to block his idea, was there was concern that mineral oil could be carcinogenic. Although Salk had used it in many, many people and in animals and had no problem, they said, well, it would take about 10 years to know if it was safe. And I was thinking, you've got to be kidding. We've got to follow these people 10 and 20 years before you'll even allow mineral oil adjuvant to be used. And in fact, one of his strongest opponents in Great Britain years later retracted his criticism, and Great Britain started using a similar type of mineral oil as an adjuvant in their vaccine.
So, and it sounds like one of the most important things he did was realize that, along with the other researchers, that influenza does mutate a lot, and the idea of sort of having to be predictive on what strains are going to be the most important. This has governed what we do with influenza vaccines to this very day.
That's absolutely right. Interestingly, though, that's where he and Thomas Francis and many of the epidemiologists differed, and that was that they thought, well, the best way to approach influenza is to predict which strain will come. And, of course, about every 10 years you can have a terrible epidemic or pandemic, and you had to predict what it would be. And, as you know, they've been wrong on numerous occasions, the CDC.
Including this year.
And Salk said, you know, that's a backward way to approach it. What you need to do is be able to make a universal vaccine that covers all of the known strains, try to have immunity against them so that they can't mutate, because you've already headed them off before they can do that. And that was a sentiment that he repeated throughout his life, although it kind of went unheeded.
My guest today is Charlotte DeCruz Jacobs, a professor of medicine at Stanford University and author of Jonas Salk, A Life. It's published by Oxford University Press. This year is the 60th anniversary, just happened about a month ago, of the announcement that the Salk vaccine worked. And for those who grew up with the scourge of polio, it was a very frightening experience, because when a polio outbreak happened in your community, you know, it would be you close the swimming pools, you close the movie theaters, because nobody was really sure how it was spread. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, in 1949, he moved over to the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. The foundation started in FDR years by a confident name, Basil O'Connor. Now, tell us a little bit about Basil O'Connor.
Okay. First, just to clarify one thing, and that is that during all of this, Falk was a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, so that he was in the traditional academic milieu. He did not, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis didn't have laboratories or offices.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So Basil O'Connor was a lawyer who was a law partner of FDR, and they couldn't have been more different. O'Connor grew up in poverty, had to sell newspapers to help keep the food on the table for the family. He was a very feisty Irishman and really wanted to get to the top of his game and make money in the law profession, and kind of made a deal with FDR. They'd be partners, and they'd have FDR's name and all that would go along with that. And FDR could work on all of his political things and have O'Connor do the work. And they became very close friends. And he really had not much interest in the whole polio effort initially until FDR actually turned it over to him as he went on to become president. And then O'Connor became passionate about it. He wanted to triumph over polio with, you know, every last ounce in his body. And he was a very, very domineering man as the director of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. No one made a decision without him. He was very directive. I think one of the most interesting things I felt when I was doing my research is the friendship between Basil O'Connor and Jonas Salk, a wonderful, wonderful friendship that developed.
And I guess Basil was also very close to FDR.
Exactly.
We know of the relationship between, say, FDR and Louis Howe, who was his political advisor, but Basil was the same sort of figure,
exactly.
It sounds like. And as Roosevelt resumed politics after he contracted polio, he sort of brought O'Connor in to, you know, be a part of Warm Springs and also help fund this amazing organization of the March of Dimes, which brought polio research to a whole new level due to the money that came in.
Absolutely. And the fascinating thing about the March of Dimes, or the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, is it was a whole effort that the public got behind, and that the public, by giving their dimes, so to speak, really wanted to conquer polio. It was just an incredible fundraising organization and funded most of the scientists doing the polio work. This was a time when the National Institutes of Health did not have large amounts of money to help scientists. Not only that, then once Salk had made the vaccine, then it was kind of taken out of his hands.
That's the most amazing part of this story. He works and develops the vaccine. Now, he was very quick. You talked about credit. He was always good to mention the people who worked with him, and he also mentioned the work of, I believe it was Tomas Enders, who helped the sort of scientific breakthrough that he capitalized on to create this vaccine. But once he has this vaccine, it's ready for clinical trials. Instead of having him coordinate it, it's taken totally out of his hands.
Well, he was a single investigator, first off. I mean, that's the incredible thing. The polio vaccine wasn't made by a large pharmaceutical house or made by a research institute. It was made by an individual man with a few research associates in his laboratory. That's incredible in itself. But what happened is once he made it, he had planned to just do some trials, give it to patients, and then compare them to patients that didn't get it and move along quickly and get it into public use. Well, O'Connor knew very well that that was never going to be enough to make the polio vaccine available nationally and to prove that it was beneficial. So he and the director of research, Weaver, at the March of Dimes, took it out of Salk's hands. And I think they were right. They said, you can't be the person who makes the vaccine and then tests it. And as an individual, there was no way he could do. There were 1.8 million subjects in this trial. This is one of the largest trials in medical history. So that they took it out of his hands, and then they conducted these trials. But the other interesting thing about the March of Dimes, this wasn't a trial that was conducted by professionals, as trials are today. This was supported and conducted by the March of Dimes, so that all the people collecting data, giving the shots, doing the randomization. Those were all volunteers. It was a volunteer army,
wow,
many of whom were housewives, that conducted this trial. That in itself is an amazing story as well.
Now, you mentioned Thomas Francis, who Salk was a colleague of during their influenza work. He is the man that actually makes the announcement on April 12th.
Yes.
And it's at his research lab at Ann Arbor, at the University of Michigan. And Salk comes to Ann Arbor. As he's walking into the auditorium, he has no idea when he's invited to speak whether he is going to take the wave of applause or if he's going to have to explain why it didn't work. That is, to me, is just utterly mind-blowing.
I'll modify it slightly. One, Thomas Francis was an esteemed epidemiologist and above any kind of criticism. He gained so much respect. So the March of Dimes asked him to analyze the data. He did not conduct the trial, and he wasn't in a laboratory. He was in a big epidemiology center. So he got all these pieces of data and did the analysis with a group of statisticians. So it was appropriate that he was the person making the announcement and giving the data from the trial. And it certainly did give it more credibility. Remember, Salk was not the favored of the scientific brotherhood at that point. And you're right, he went for an entire year not knowing what the results would be. He, in his heart, knew that the polio vaccine was effective. He knew that from the trials he had done, but he did not know what the trials would be and how they would hold up statistically until breakfast right before the talk. So he did have about a little time to think about it, a very short time.
Well, after this announcement's made, you would think that, and the whole world did rejoice, and it immediately became the Salk vaccine, which rubbed, again, some colleagues wrong. But yet, even after this major study, the Sabin crowd, the people who backed the Sabin oral vaccine, which was a live vaccine, this internecine warfare went on for years afterwards over which was the better polio vaccine.
That's absolutely right. Within, I would say, probably 5 years after the Salk vaccine had been introduced, which, by the way, he really tried to get them not to call it the Salk vaccine. But by that time, paralytic polio had been reduced by about 90% in the United States. But still, most virologists thought that only with a live poliovirus vaccine could you eradicate the disease, because it would cause a low-grade infection and give you better life protection. And Sabin was the leader of that group, and Sabin was highly regarded in the scientific community. And so with funding, he was also funded by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. He concocted a live polio virus vaccine. He wasn't the only one. There were several. And mostly did his trials in Russia and other countries. And by 1962, the United States government had recommended replacing Salk's vaccine with the Sabin vaccine. And they cited cost and convenience as their reasons. Salk spent the rest of his life kind of as this lone warrior trying to get that decision overruled. He kept pointing out that the vaccine or the virus in the vaccine could do what's called revert to virulence, that has suddenly become a much more virulent virus and actually cause paralysis. And he went up against all the major medical decision makers in the United States, the CDC, the Surgeon General, the American Medical Association, and everyone pretty much ignored his arguments. There were actually some cases of paralysis caused by the Sabin vaccine, but by then it had become entrenched, and by 1968 you couldn't get the Salk vaccine. No one manufactured it anymore. So it was, it's a testament to his, I call it kind of legendary tenacity, that he continued to write letters, to testify, to bug people, to try to get the Sabin vaccine delicensed. And it finally was about 4 years after Salk died.
Yeah, finally. Then now we use the variant of the Salk vaccine
today.
Yeah. In the book, Jonas Salk, A Life, you tell the story of creating the vaccine. Of course, this amazing celebrity that came out of it. And his later work, he worked on coming up with a cancer vaccine with no success. He also worked on early work on trying to create a vaccine for HIV. He created the Salk Institute, and the book does talk about that. But what really amazes me, here is Jonas Salk, this one man, you know, I mean, He's right up there with Jenner and Pasteur, really, in the way most people think about him. He was snubbed by the Nobel Prize. He never received the Nobel Prize in medicine, although probably most people think he received it. And more importantly, he was blocked from the National Academy of Science. And again, it gets to this horrible snubbing of his professional peers. He received every honor imaginable from the general public, from Congress to the president on down, but the scientific community pretty much ignored his great success.
That's true. So in terms of the Nobel Prize, actually, the details of his nomination were made public a few years ago by the secretary of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. And it turned out that there was a Swedish scientist named Sven Gard who was on this five-man committee who reviewed the nominations, every one of Salk's nominations, and said they were not prize-worthy. The National Academy of Sciences, no one knows exactly what happens, but it only takes one person to blackball someone, and there are various stages in which their name can fall off. And Sabin used to call Salk a kitchen chemist. He used to say, oh, we didn't make any original discovery. You could go into a kitchen and do what he did.
Now, that is the criticism, that he never really did any original science work. Would you disagree with that assessment?
Well, I think it depends on, if you compare him to Thomas Enders, I think that is true. But the impact that he has had on the world in terms of his vaccine, and it did take some clever maneuvering to make the vaccine. It wasn't a basic discovery, finding some new enzyme or something, but it really is a sad day if the National Academy of Sciences doesn't recognize that type of contribution to science.
In fact, it is tricky how you made the formula. In fact, there was one pharmaceutical company that actually cut a few corners and actually had an outbreak of polio from the vaccine because the way they were straining the material created for the vaccine allowed some live particles to get in.
Well, actually, it allowed particles to not be totally killed.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. That was a different era. There was not great government oversight. And after that happened, and Salk found the problem pretty quickly, the government tightened its oversight on vaccines tremendously, and there's never been another incident such as that.
On the 60th anniversary of this announcement, how should we remember Jonas Salk?
That's a very good question, because when he was asked what he wanted his biographer to write about him, he said, the truth. So, which became a little bit difficult because he was a bit of an introvert and he had this protective shield. He always had a certain persona to the public. He's somebody who his dreams and his drive to solve the problems of the world both enshrined him and isolated. And in fact, he was someone who was so passionate about aiding humanity that he was able to rise above all the pain from his fame, all the barbs from the scientific community, and push on. And I think the world is better for it.
A great man. The name of the book is Jonas Salk, Alive. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Charlotte DeCruz Jacobs is a professor of medicine at Stanford University and the author of Jonas Salk, Alive. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.